pleasure to greet you to the first annual Horowitz Flaum Memorial Lecture. As I mentioned yesterday in shul, it was quite a number of months ago when Max Horowitz approached me and we began to discuss a proper type of memorial for his parents, his in-laws, and his brother Leo. And the suggestion that I made, which he and his wife accepted, was that a lecture series be set up and that we give the opportunity for people to come and learn, listen, and be able to perpetuate those values which the Horowitz and Flaum family had during their lifetime. Sometimes a plaque or other such type of memorial might seem to us to have a very long life, but I think the Torah that will be studied here and in subsequent years will live far longer than that. I'd like to make special mention of a member of the family who's here, Rabbi Tzvi Flaum, the Rav of the Torah Center of Hillcrest, a nephew of the Horowitzes. And I'd like to reiterate once again that the families that we are memorializing here through this study of Torah were families who came to the United States and perpetuated the values of Torah, the study of Torah, the living of Torah throughout their lives. And it is a fitting memorial that we come together tonight for. Our speaker this evening, and I'd like to be very brief in introducing him, as difficult as that might be. Rabbi J. David Bleich is a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzhak Elchanan of Yeshiva University. He is a professor of Jewish law and ethics at Cardozo Law School and has written extensively on many, many topics and a number of books, ranging from, and I think this was his doctoral thesis, Providence and the Philosophy of Gersonides, Birkas HaChama, which was one of the best books that Art Scroll has put out, to a number of books on topics that, on the topic, in fact, that we're going to speak about tonight in much greater length, Judaism and Healing. He edited Jewish Bioethics and Contemporary Halakhic Problems in two volumes. He is also the author of a column which appears regularly in Tradition, the scholarly publication of the Rabbinical Council of America entitled Survey of Recent Halachic Literature. He is a contributing editor of Shema, and it is a pleasure to be able to read his writing, not only in the type of periodicals that we would expect it to be in, but as well, he is a reasoned and articulate defender of Torah True Judaism in many other publications such as Shema, Judaism, and others. It's a great pleasure for us to be able to have Rabbi Bleich with us, and I'm sure that this evening's lecture on the topic of organ donation and transplants, a halachic view, will be one that we will all gain from. I would ask you just please to keep any questions that you have for the end of the lecture, when Rabbi Bleich will give us the opportunity to question and discuss the topic that he will be discussing. It's my pleasure to introduce Rabbi J. David Bleich.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Wagner, for an overly generous introduction. Let me try to put the evening's topic in some sort of framework, in some type of context. In general, there are probably no issues more pressing today than issues of what is known in the world out there as bioethics. For Jews, every ethical question becomes ultimately a matter of halacha. I would draw your attention to the opening comments of the Bartanura in his Perush on Pirkei Avos. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai u'Masorah liYeshua, and the Rav is troubled at this introductory phrase. Why does the Tanna at the very outset of Pirkei Avos emphasize that Moshe Rabbeinu received the Torah at Har Sinai? And it proceeds to tell us because the contents of Pirkei Avos are different from other Masechtos of Shas. Ein Masechtos zu miyusedes al pirush mitzvah mehamitzvos. This Masechta of all others is not devoted to the explication of any particular specific mitzvah. Ela kula musorim umidos. It's composed entirely of ethical dicta and principles. Ulefi shechachme umay sa'olam bodu musorim milibam. And because the wise men of the nations of the world have propounded ethical principles in accordance with the inclination of their hearts, therefore the Tanna emphasizes that the Musorim and Midos, the ethical principles contained in this Masechta, the ethical teachings of Judaism, are in themselves part of the Masorah, and with regard to Jewish ethics, no less than Jewish halakha, the principle is Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai U'Mesora LeYeshua. All of that is part and parcel of a Torah which the Rebbeinu Shel Olam gave to Moshe on Har Sinai, and which has been transmitted to us from generation to generation. And in no area is that more true than medicine itself. Medicine and the so-called medical ethic problems are all reflected in halacha, in the dinim found in Shulchan Aruch and in Pesachim. The very practice of medicine itself presents a problem to a believing Jew. After all, the Torah says, Ani Hashem Refecha. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam is our physician. And if God is the physician, who needs a second opinion? That was the basis of the heresy of the ancient Karaites, who maintained that seeking the services of the physician was contrary to the edict of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. Chazal recognized the problem. Says the Gemara, "Bobekame v'rape yirape mikan shenitno rishus l'reife l'rapes." The posuk, in an entirely different context, speaks about the notion of healing in a peripheral manner, and Chazal tell us that it is because the theory includes this short, succinct phrase, "V'rape yirape." He shall surely heal, that we derive the principle that the physician has the authority, the dispensation, to practice the healing arts. Rashi, the Rashba, commenting on the statement of the Gemara, tell us that if man were left to his own reason, given belief, emun in the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, he should find the practice of medicine abhorrent and even in a certain sense irrational. It is, after all, nira kiseiser gzeiras hamelech. Where does sickness come from if not from the Rebbeinu Shel Olam himself? Sickness, illness, is a decree of God. How can man presume to thwart the divine decree? Rachmona machi viu masi. God afflicts, and man has the colossal chutzpah to presume to heal. And the answer to that problem is a clear recognition that man practices the healing arts. The physician endeavors to heal the patient to the best of his ability. And the patient seeks the ministrations of the physician only because the Rebbeinu Shel Olam has permitted this. In effect, the doctor becomes the shutif of the Rebbeinu Shalom. He becomes an active partner in fulfilling the Rebbeinu Shalom's providential design. But of course, if one recognizes that in addition to a diploma from a medical school and a license from the appropriate state licensing board, one also requires divine dispensation, it should not be at all shocking to discover that this license, this dispensation, is accompanied by certain limitations. After all, without a posuk of Arapa Yarape, we would be a nation of faith healers. And that's made very clear in a medrash commenting upon a posuk in this week's Sedra. A very strange medrash. Chazal tell us that Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel were walking in the street one day, and a Jew came over to them and told them that he is ill. What this sick Jew expected, I don't know. But Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel reached into the pocket of their garment, and they took out some medicines, and they gave it to the man, and they told him to take the medicine, and in Yirtz Hashem, he'll have a refuah shleima. And the Jew responded with a look of bewilderment and asked, how in the world could Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel, no less, prescribe medicines for the cure of an illness? And they proceeded in a typically Semitic way, instead of answering the question, to ask him a question. And they asked, Ma malachtecha, what is your trade? And he answered that he's a farmer. And they asked him, what do you have in your hand? And he answers, he has a cutting implement to cut down the wheat in the field. And they asked him, and who gave you permission to cut the wheat in the field? To which he responded by saying that if I don't farm my land, and if I don't harvest the crops, my wife, my children will die of starvation. And they proceeded to tell him that just as man has dispensation from the Rebbeinu Shlomo himself to till the soil, to harvest the crop, so also does he have permission to use medicine in curing illness. B'zeas apecho teichalechem is a klolot. But it has implications which go far beyond the literal meaning of the curse directed to Adam HaRishon. Previously, the Rebbeinu Shlom told Adam HaRishon, Mikol Eitz Hadon Ochel Teichel. Had the Rebbeinu Shlom not uttered the words, from the fruit of every tree in Gan Eden may you eat, Adam HaRishon would of necessity have died of starvation. Otherwise, what gives him the right to appropriate for himself that which is the property of the Creator, of the Rebbeinu Shlomo? Mikol Eitz Hagan Achol Teichal is a matir. It grants permission to something which is ordinarily and under other conditions forbidden. It's a matir of the prohibition loisigza. And of course, it comes with a condition. It's circumscribed. You can eat everything, except one little tree is off bounds. With regard to that tree, you have no permission. But even having received permission to eat of the fruits that he finds in Gan Eden, Adam HaRishon has no need, but also no right to plow the soil which he finds. It's one thing to invite a guest into one's house and to put a fruit platter on the table and say, help yourself. But the same individual who has permission to help himself from the fruit bowl, if he walks out in the backyard and begins digging in the garden, will find that the welcome mat is no longer available for him. The Rabbeinu Shloim gives Adam HaRishon permission to eat the fruit. He doesn't give him permission to redesign the orchard, to plow the field, to root out that which has been planted and replace it with something else. That comes only afterwards, when he is told, Kitz v'dada tatzmiach loch, and b'zeas apecho techo lechem. Of course it's a curse. Were there no thorns and no weeds, it wouldn't be necessary. But now the Rabbeinu Shloim finds it necessary to grant Adam HaRishon permission not only to pluck the fruit, but even to be a mazik, even to what seems to be an act of damaging the territory which has been given to him and placed under his jurisdiction. He now has the right to dig up the soil if Adam finds it necessary to do so. And later, when the Rabbeinu Shloim utters the words Rapa Yerapa, he has granted Adam further dispensation to conduct himself in a manner which to an onlooker may appear to be Seiser Gzeiras HaMelech. Of course it's not. It's not thwarting the divine decree, because all of this is part of the divine decree. It's part of the divine decree because just as Adam HaRishon was charged with completing the work of creation, so is he charged with being an active partner in the exercise of divine guardianship, divine providence, in practicing the healing arts. And that, it seems to me, is precisely the meaning of Chazal when they tell us that this was the response of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shmuel, when they presented the medicine to this poor farmer who didn't understand how it is that he was permitted to take the medicine. They were in effect telling him that the Rabbeinu Shloim created a world and placed man in it. He created Nefoshis Rabbis v'chesreinon. He created human needs and provided the wherewithal to satisfy those needs. And those needs extend to food and drink, and unfortunately at times, to medication in order to cure illness. But of course, wherever there is a requirement for permission, wherever dispensation is needed, one may anticipate that this permission will not be blanket, will not be all-inclusive. And if it turns out that in the practice of agriculture, for example, there are some things that a Jew cannot do, he dare not plant kilayim, he dare not farm his soil by planting different species together, all that the Jew can do is recognize that the Rabbeinu Shloim has given dispensation, but the dispensation is limited. It's not all-encompassing. And if it turns out that the Rabbeinu Shloim has granted us authority to save lives by the practice of medicine, it may just turn out to be the case that in some circumstances it is not permitted to engage in such practices, even if, unfortunately, human lives may be lost as a result. All that a Jew can do is recognize that under those circumstances, this is the Gzeiras HaMelech, this is the edict of the Creator of the universe, and man cannot intervene where he has no authority to intervene. And of course, the obligations of Pikuach Nefesh are virtually all-encompassing. They're extremely broad, but that doesn't mean that limitations don't exist. Let me try to spell out some of those limitations and how they seem to impact upon donation of organs and organ transplantation. The first limitation, the limitation that virtually everyone is aware of, is the statement of Nadiv Yehuda in his classic tshuva dealing with autopsies. And he was asked the question with regard to the permissibility of an autopsy in a particular case, and he responded by presenting a general principle with regard to pikuach nefesh. And he said, everyone knows that if there is a sick child on Shabbos, one does whatever is necessary to cure the child. If the doctor says the child needs warm milk, then you cut down a tree, you chop the wood, you make a fire, you put a pot on the fire, and you boil the milk. Pikuach nefesh is doiche, virtually every prohibition. And even questionable pikuach nefesh, even a situation in which it's not at all clear that what is being done will have the desired effect, it's not at all clear that the patient is really deathly ill, but he might be deathly ill, that's enough to sanction chilul Shabbos. But, says the Nedev Yehuda, imagine the situation of a mother who has a perfectly healthy child, and she wakes up one Shabbos morning, and she says to herself, the child might just get sick during the course of the day. And if a child will become sick, and I call the doctor, he may just prescribe hot milk. Therefore, in order not to lose precious minutes, because time may be of essence, I'll make a fire and I'll boil the milk so that the hot milk will be ready to treat the child should the child become sick and should the doctor prescribe hot milk. Says Nadiv Yehuda, that is in effect a reductio ad absurdum. That's obviously incorrect. That certainly is not permissible. What then is the principle to be applied? Says the Nadiv Yehuda that when there is a chayla lefoneinu, when we have a sick person in our presence, then everything is permissible. Or, to use the language of American constitutional law, we have a clear and present danger. When you know that there is something that has to be attended to, then the Torah gives dispensation. But when there isn't a danger present before us, under those circumstances, this act cannot be construed as an act of pikuach nefesh. And so is developed this general principle with regard to the permissibility of nivul hames, defiling the corpse. Yes, if there is another patient who can benefit from what the pathologist hopes to learn on post-mortem examination, fine, it's permissible. But if there is no other patient who now suffers from a similar ailment, who can be helped, at least possibly helped, by what will be discovered on autopsy, then the procedure is not permissible. That principle, the principle of a chayla lefoneinu, has been expanded by later achrenim and applied in different cases. For example, the Chazon Ish speaks of a situation in which there is an epidemic out there, but there is no epidemic in this city yet. But epidemics have a way of spreading. They spread from one city to another. And certain prophylactic measures can be taken in order to prevent an individual from catching the disease. Says the Chazon Ish, of course, you don't have to have the patient in a hospital bed in front of you. If you know that the disease is in the next shtetl, that's enough. You can then do in this city, even though there's been no sign of the disease, you can do whatever is necessary in order to help future patients. Even though, at the present moment, not a single person in this locale has as yet been affected. essentially the same principle was adopted by the late Rav Unterman and applied in a military situation. Apparently, the army, the Israeli army, came to him and asked whether it is permissible to carry battlefield hospitals with you when you go into battle. Remember that when the soldiers leave their military camps, not a single shot has been fired. Baruch Hashem, at that point, everybody is perfectly healthy. There is no chole lefoneinu in a literal sense of that concept. Nobody here is sick. But everybody knows that the derech hateva, when you go to battle, there are fakenim gedach casualties. When you shoot bullets, the enemy shoots also. And vinisht, somebody gets hit by a stray bullet. You know that there are going to be casualties. And so, says Rav Unterman, when you know that there are going to be casualties, and this is known with a virtual certainty, then you can take in advance whatever measures are necessary to deal with those individuals who will be in a state of pikuach nefesh. I would redefine the phrase of the Nevi'im and say that what is really necessary is not the chole lefoneinu, but the sakona lefoneinu, the danger before our eyes. And by sakona, danger, I think we must understand the sibas hasakona lefoneinu, the cause of the danger before us. If the cause of danger is present here and now, that is sufficient to render whatever is necessary for pikuach nefesh permissible. And the decision to go to battle is itself the cause of danger. Wherever the cause of danger is present, it appears that the chole lefoneinu criterion has been satisfied. Much has been said and written with regard to the establishment of organ banks and applying the Nevi'im Yehuda's principle, the general rule of thumb seems to be that when there is a patient who requires a cadaver transplant for purposes of pikuach nefesh, because his chances of survival and longevity anticipation are greater with the donated organ than without, then of course, it's all permissible. Sure, there is an issur of nivul ames. Autopsies are ordinarily forbidden. Removing an organ from a cadaver is ordinarily forbidden. But it's an issur on par with other issurim of the Torah, each of which is suspended for purposes of saving a life. But if right now there is no recipient who is waiting for the organ, instead you want to put the organ in a bank and use it at some future time, the general response has been that under those circumstances there's no chole lefoneinu, and therefore this procedure is not warranted. Then along came an incident that was reported in the press, what was it, a year ago, a little bit more than a year ago, an incident involving Israeli soldiers who became the victims of whatever it was, and they required skin grafts. And we were told that there is not sufficient skin available because the hospitals in Eretz Yisrael don't have skin banks. I've been reliably informed that it was totally false, that it wasn't true, that it was the case that there was enough skin available for the soldiers in need, but whatever. Whereupon immediately was forthcoming a psak halacha from rabbonim who are recognized poskim to the effect that, of course, if soldiers' lives are in danger and there is the danger of an explosion in a tank which requires skin for a life-saving skin graft, then of course it's permissible to stock as much skin as is necessary to cope with those emergencies. The principle is really whether there is a direct cause and effect relationship between the act of nivul ames and the saving of a life. If this act of nivul ames, the act of defiling the body by removing tissues or organs, will lead to the saving of a life, and there is reasonable anticipation that that will be the result, then the requirements of chayla lefoneinu have been met. When there is no reasonable anticipation that this organ will actually be used in a situation involving danger to life, then the principle is entirely different. How to apply it with regard to any particular organ in any particular geographic area is dependent very much upon the medical circumstances. And an answer valid today in New York may not be valid even today in Timbuktu or tomorrow in New York. These are facts which are subject to change. Realia have a way of changing on us, and the answer to the question depends upon the total contextual situation. With regard to the skin grafts, it's fairly clear and obvious. Skin can be stored for virtually forever. And if you save skin for purposes of performing skin grafts on individuals who will need it, it is to be assumed that in the course of time, skin will be required for such procedures, and this skin will presumably be used to save life. If you're dealing with other organs that degenerate quite rapidly and cannot be preserved for any significant period of time, the answer is likely to be very different. But who knows what will happen next week, next month, or next year? Who knows when physicians will discover ways of preserving hearts and kidneys so that they can be used weeks and months afterwards. Right now, the organs have to be used virtually immediately. Otherwise, from the medical perspective, they are quite useless. But who knows what forms of organ preservation may be discovered, and hence the answer is very likely to change when and if circumstances change. That's one limitation upon this general dispensation to practice medicine. There is another limitation as well, and that is, there is no obligation to place oneself in danger in order to save the life of another individual. Even in circumstances where it is known with certainty that failure to intervene means that this individual will surely die, the principle itself is the subject of controversy. There are some poskim, a minority to be sure, who maintain that an individual must endanger himself in order to save somebody else. A kind of category of ein sofik meitzei midei vadai. That person is certainly going to die. You're only endangering yourself, but there's a very good chance that you will emerge unscathed. Therefore, forget about this questionable sacrifice of life in order to engage in what is the certain saving of a life. The vast majority of Poskim maintain that no individual is obligated to place himself in serious danger, and I add the qualifying term serious. No individual is required to place himself in serious danger in order to save somebody else's life. Moreover, even if there is no question of individual danger, there is a guarantee that the individual in question will not die as a result. But what is required of him is an organ or a limb of his body. In such a context, the Radvaz declares that a person who offers a donation of his limb or organ is a chosid sheikh, a pious fool. What he means, it seems to me, is that even in terms of pikuach nefesh, there is a limitation to what an individual is obligated to do to save other person's life. Some authorities maintain that an individual is not obligated to spend more than chemish nechosid, more than 20% of his capital worth. But he is required to spend a full 20% in order to save even a single life. Other poskim maintain that he is obligated to spend kol mamona, his entire fortune is less valuable than a single life. And therefore, if there is a possibility of saving a life, but it costs a person's entire capital worth, he must cheerfully spend his fortune to save the life. But no one is obligated to spend more than he has. And there are some things that are more valuable to a person than all his earthly possessions. A hand, a foot, a limb is certainly to any rational person more valuable than any earthly possessions he might have. And if a person is confronted with a choice, a rational individual would cheerfully surrender whatever he has rather than lose a limb or an organ. Says the Radvaz, no individual has to allow his hand to be cut off in order to save another person's life. By the same token, I see no prohibition against sacrificing an organ in order to save another person's life. To state that there is no obligation is to state that the obligation of pikuach nefesh is not so all-encompassing that it requires even that sacrifice. But by the same token, I'm not aware of a prohibition against expending more than 20% of one's fortune, or even more than one's entire fortune, or even a limb or an organ.
Informative evening. I would like to invite all of you for refreshments, and for those of you who have not yet davened Maariv, we're going to have a minyan in the Beis Medrash in 2 minutes.